Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm going to be speaking today about the growing dangers of antibiotic resistance with David Hume, MD, who directs the Antibiotic Resistance Project at the Pew Charitable Trust, and Aaron Duffy, Chief of Research and Development at CARB-X, which stands for Combating Antibiotic Resistant Bacteria Biopharmaceutical Accelerator. CARB-X, and you can learn more about both of their work at saveantibiotics.org. That's one word, saveantibiotics.org, and carb-x.org, carb-x.org. On Freeform, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, culture, and more, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Show airs on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on kpfk.org Thursdays at 4 p.m. Pacific. Streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on tunein.com, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere, on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, most major podcast sites, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net. I experienced a serious staph infection in 2013 after a physician's assistant drained my left knee in a doctor's office. And I spent 10 days in the hospital, including two surgeries to clean out my knee, 17 days in a rehab center, and 4 months on crutches before I regained the use of my knee. And for those 4 months, I needed two-hour-long antibiotic infusions daily into a PICC line. It is my understanding that my staph infection was fierce and aggressive, and thus the two surgeries. But the scariest part were the days after the diagnosis and before they determined that vancomycin would likely work. I may be wrong in exactly how I remember this, but I don't think I was the only one who worried that it might be antibiotic-resistant MRSA. Imagine that other possibility, because I did, a potentially lethal infection for which there is no effective treatment. And every day that we continue our current practices with regard to antibiotics, we threaten the efficacy of the antibiotics we have. And sadly, the pipeline for the future is not up to the task. Evolution ultimately wins. In 2019, about 1.27 million people died directly due to antimicrobial resistance. That's significantly more than from COVID in 2 years. And I don't think I've heard anything that leads me to believe things are about to get better. How do we let this happen? I mean, it sounds insane that the incentives and the pathways of power would be such in our society that we would choose to abuse this life-saving gift of our own discovery and development to weaken its power for others or for the future, and to do so for the short-term benefit of just a few. We're talking about life and death on a massive scale, but even short of life and death, the loss of antibiotics would be hugely destructive. Just one example. I've got an appointment in a couple of weeks to begin the process of replacing my right knee. It's a long story, but after the infection, for some reason, the pain and swelling in my left knee stopped. Nobody knows why. But the point is, when we lose antibiotics, replacement surgery, joint replacement surgery, will be a thing of the past. When we lose a great deal of our ability to fight infection, we will be in a different world, and we're not ready for it. The level of public awareness and any responsiveness I've seen so far does not look to me to be at the scale of the crisis we face. It looks to me that the whole ecosystem of antibiotic use and development is not as robust as it needs to be to keep pace with microbial evolution. Is the system broken? And if so, what's the evidence? How do we know it's broken? And finally, how do we fix it? David Hume, MD, directs Pew's Antibiotic Resistance Project. And before joining Pew, he practiced medicine at Children's National Medical Center, where he developed and co-chaired the Antibiotic Stewardship Program. And he was an assistant professor of pediatrics at George Washington University School of Medicine. Aaron Duffy, PhD, Chief of Research and Development at Carbex, has 17 plus years of drug discovery and problem-solving experience in the antibiotic field. Her previous experience includes time at Pfizer Central Research, Ashelion Pharmaceuticals, and at Melinta Therapeutics, a developer of new antibiotics. Welcome, David Yoon, Aaron Duffy, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Monday, March 28th. Okay, I like listeners to get a feel for the people that I talk with, not just their ideas and their work. So could you each tell me a bit about your personal path to the work you do today? And feel free to mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing. Let's start. You're nodding. Let's start with you, Aaron.
My name is Aaron Duffy, and my path to where we are today, I think, let me trace it back to when I left Pfizer. I started my career at Pfizer when I was a kid. I'm a chemist by training, and I went there to do structure-based drug design, which is, you know, basically the modeling of potential new drugs. And it was a great place to start a career, but I was pulled to biotech by a colleague of mine who was founding an antiviral company, that's Achillion that you mentioned. And they needed someone to come and help them build their structure-based design team. So I did that. But I wasn't there very long. This was right around 2000, 2001. And a friend of mine, former colleague from Pfizer, called and said, I'm starting this antibiotic company based on there was a paper in Science magazine about the solution of the atomic details of the ribosome. And the ribosome is and has been the most prolific of all targets for the development of new antibiotics.
I gotta ask you, just so people can keep up with us, what's the ribosome?
Yeah, good question. It's basically the factory in all cells that makes more stuff. And that's true in human cells, and it's true in bacterial cells too. And so when an antibiotic inhibits that engine, then it doesn't produce more material, and therefore bacteria don't replicate any longer.
So you can affect the ribosome, you can stop the production of the dangerous bacteria.
Exactly. You know, and it's not the only target, but, you know, a lot of the antibiotics you've heard of, Zithromax, you know, and many erythromycin, these are molecules that work there. Tetracyclines, which a lot of people take, aminoglycosides, lots of different antibiotics, linazolid, so-called Zyvox, so lots of different antibiotics fine-tuned to its function. And yet, until the structures were solved, no one understood how they did it, okay? And so if you don't understand how they do it, then it's really hard, other than making minor modifications, to do something really innovative and new. And so these structures were solved by two labs at Yale University, one in the lab of Tom Steitz and Peter Moore. And together, you know, they brought different things to the party, but together they solved these structures. And all of a sudden, it was like someone turned the lights on in the cave, and you could see how all these different antibiotics did their work. It wasn't in the same way. But then all of a sudden, there was this promise that you could develop new antibiotics, make meaningful new classes, which would confuse the bacteria for a while because they wouldn't have recognized them before. So it would take time for them to figure out how to make themselves impenetrable or more challenging to target.
Right. And what we're talking about there is what I referred to before, which is the molecular evolution, that the molecules evolve amazingly quickly. And that's what they're looking for, is ways to survive.
Absolutely. So most of your, not all, but certainly most of the antibiotics that we've come to know and love are natural products, meaning bacteria made them as weapons to fight other bacteria. So then if you think about it, then, you know, I mean, just to continue with this war thing, which is, you know, not great in today's, you know, backdrop, but so for bacteria to, you know, get better, they have to figure out how to change, you know, how to bring in new weapons in order to make themselves more robust against the other bacteria. So they're used to doing this, okay, and they've always done it. And so this is where this need of having new ways of, you know, addressing the bacteria just makes them have to stop and think, you know, God, what do I need for this war? So So anyway, so we went there to do this. And ultimately, by the way, that foundational research was the subject of a Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 2009. Okay, so then I went there, we built a team. We were on our way, we had products in the clinic, and a couple of things happened. One of them was around 2005, 2006, there was an antibiotic that was on the market called Ketek. And that was meant to be a replacement to, or a next generation to Zithromax. So you use it for, ear infections, sore throats, all that stuff, kids, good for kids. I mean, every parent knows Zithromax, right? But it had some idiosyncratic safety issues once it was on the market. And once you peel back the layers of the onion, this was really a problem, and it got pretty political. The FDA were called on the floor of Congress, why are you killing our children? Very, very dramatic. And so this served to make the forward progress of development of new antibiotics pretty challenging. And so for about 3 or 4 years, companies like ours, and we were a little company, we built it from the ground up, private, scratching for resources. So really how you, move forward so that investors can value you, which is about products close to patients, became harder. But we continued. And then around 2012, got a big break. So the FDA sort of issued new guidelines, making the path open again to developing new antibiotics. That was one thing. And then Congress, recognizing that there had been this period of time, where products were delayed in getting to the market, Congress passed an act called the GAIN Act to generate antibiotic incentives now. And there were two things about that. One was to increase the patent life of an existing antibiotic by 5 additional years over top of some other exclusivity. And that's, of course, important because if your product's sitting on the sidelines, right, then, by the time it comes to market, there's not much time before generics come in.
And what we're talking about in that case is incentives and
exactly. And
extending one's ownership over what they've developed is an incentive.
Exactly. And then the second was that they changed the time frame for review of the dossier to, to approve the new antibiotic. So it's sort of a fast track from, I think, 12 months to 9 months. So these were great.
So you get return potentially quicker and you hold it longer.
Exactly. So these were great. So off we went and we conducted our pivotal trials to bring our first antibiotic forward to the market. And we continued to do earlier research. And we did gain FDA approval for that product in the summer of 2017. And we were scaling up to build our sales force, with an expected launch in early 2018. And at that time, we did a reverse merger with an antibiotic company called Sempra that had had some, unfortunate missteps with their lead product. And so we did a reverse merger with them. They were a public company and they had cash and we were building a sales force. And so we needed cash and wanted a public shelf. So that was great. And then we had this idea, which was, well, you have one product going into the hospital in the bag of the salesperson. It'd be more efficient if you had a few in there, because it's one call. Hey, look at, these different products we have. And so we in-licensed 3 additional antibiotics from the medicines company who were divesting themselves. And it looked great. 4 products, 2 newly on the market and, 2 that had been on the market for a while. But over the next 3 quarters, the sales of these products, and, launches take a while, but the sales of these products were in the, call it $10 to $13 million a quarter for all 4. Now, let me contrast that for a minute. Those commercials you see on TV for Humira. So I think Humira annually is somewhere in the $16 to $18 billion range. Okay. So now go back to the 10 to 13 million, divide that by 4 products. And you see, really, you can't keep these products on the market for very long. So we made the hard decision to focus on our cash on the products, to jettison the research. I was the chief scientist at the time, and try to make a go of that. And so at that point, I found a home for our preclinical technology programs. I found jobs for my colleagues, and then closed the doors. Well, before this, we had had a grant from CARB-X, my organization, which supports the discovery and early development of new antibiotics, vaccines, and preventatives and diagnostics. And so I knew the mission, and you know, really believed in that, especially given.
Right. And let me just emphasize for people, what you're saying is that CARB-X, which is where you moved, doesn't do the research itself.
No.
But it funds research, which, of course, is essential.
Exactly. We fund it from all over the world. And so CARB-X was, you know, CARB-X began in 2016. This was now 2019. They had built the processes and a portfolio and wanted to build an internal research team to really support these programs and help accelerate them from a scientific perspective.
Oh, in other words, so in addition to giving funding, you would also be able to give expertise.
Exactly, because the truth is that most of our companies and most of the companies in this space today, because the large pharmaceutical companies recognize this mathematics problem that I talked about, they're not doing the work. So it's these little companies. Sometimes there aren't even five people in the company. So they might be really good at their foundational technology, but no idea how to develop a drug. And so that's where we come in, is to not only give them the funds to do it, but help them navigate the path.
Okay. So now someone might think, well, wow, she really went into some detail there. But I appreciate that, because what you've done is you've described, you know, your experience is reflective of the problems we're facing, that a company that was actually doing groundbreaking research and developing useful products couldn't stay in the business because they couldn't afford those commercials we see during the news, you know? And so, as I say, it's your personal experience, but it really is reflective of a great deal of the issue. It's, in other words, what we're going to talk about in this hour is not just that the microbes are evolving to defeat our efforts to defeat them. That's going on. But that in the human space, in the space of economics and finance and business and incentives, the microbe has every incentive to evolve. We do not supply every incentive necessary to evolve our antibiotics. So thank you very much, Aaron. David, your experience, your path.
Yeah, so this is a great kind of a juxtaposition to Aaron's story, because I think each of us are telling the two halves of the same coin that Terrence, you mentioned earlier, why we are here today because of antibiotic resistance. You just heard about the antibiotic development issues and the challenges that Aaron just described. My story is on the other side of how overuse of antibiotics has led to us to this point where the evolution you mentioned has been really accelerated by human behavior around antibiotic use and essentially overuse and inappropriate usage. So I started, just like many of my colleagues in infectious diseases, especially in pediatric infectious diseases, we work with antibiotics all the time. And during my training years and during my years as a practicing clinician, we saw a lot of children with antibiotic resistant infections. And that's one of the key points I try to make, is that we do worry about where this could go and how much it could get worse. But for many patients in the hospitals, especially the very vulnerable population, antibiotic resistance is already here. And Terrence, you described your experience. And in the 2000s, there was a vast epidemic of community spread MRSA or MRSA infections, which is what you experienced with. So a lot of that is already here, and it's not uncommon and to see when you talk to infectious disease doctors of stories of patients where they had a patient in the hospital who had a bloodstream infection, and they cultured the bacteria and it turns out to be resistant against every drug that is out there, and the doctors and the healthcare providers' hands are tied. That's when you start reaching for the experimental drugs. That's when you start reaching into the cupboards and bring back drugs that you long ago retired because of high toxicity issues. And it's just not an ideal situation. that was the background of my clinical work. When I joined the stat faculty at Children's National, I was also tasked with starting up, which back then was still a fairly novel concept, of creating what's called an antibiotic stewardship program in the hospitals. Now, fortunately now, antibiotic stewardship programs are required now by accrediting organizations like the Joint Commission or regulatory agencies like Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. But back then, it was still, this is what we're talking about in 2008, 2009, it was still a relatively new concept. What antibiotic stewardship programs are designed to do in the hospitals is to make sure you're monitoring the use and prescribing patterns of antibiotics and try to make sure that the antibiotics are used only when they are truly necessary. And when they are needed, that they are being used at the right dose, at the right, right length of treatment time, and the right type of antibiotics. And so antibiotics stewardship is not just about, reducing unnecessary antibiotic use. It's really about optimizing antibiotics to make sure that those patients, there are situations where, like your MRSA infection, where antibiotics are absolutely needed. And it's extremely important for stewardship programs to make sure that for those patients, the antibiotics are optimized in the best possible way to maximize the chance of cure of the infections. So that's where my journey started in this, is where, trying to create antibiotic stewardship programs, program at the local level. And there's a lot of science that turns out to feed into that, because we're still talking about not just about medical issues or clinical challenges, but it's all about human behavior too. And as antibiotic stewardship programs became more prevalent across different hospitals, we started seeing a lot of positive results. Unnecessary antibiotic use started coming down in the hospitals. And in many cases, if you look at what's called an antibiogram, which is every hospital has one, it's basically an annual or biannual compilation of all the resistance patterns from the bacteria that were sampled from patients in a given facility. Those antibiograms also reflected positive changes, where the resistance rates for certain drugs against certain bacteria started coming down after the implementation of antibiotic stewardship efforts. So as we were doing that, then this opportunity came up at the Food Charitable Trust, which is an organization, this organization I currently work for is a research policy organization. We try to find solutions to a lot of different issues affecting, every aspect of life, many different aspects of life, including public health. And they were starting up an antibiotic resistance project, and they were attacking it from multiple angles. But one of the main streams was to find ways to reduce inappropriate antibiotic use. And so that's when I joined Pew with this idea that, perhaps there's a way to, kind of accelerate the adoption of antibiotic stewardship across all the different healthcare facilities. I just talked a lot about the evolution of antibiotic stewardship programs in hospitals and inpatient settings, but we still have a lot more to go, because, outpatient or your doctor's office, your clinics, that's where the majority of antibiotics in healthcare are being prescribed. It's estimated up to 80%, and they're still not good infrastructures or, activities in place to ensure antibiotic stewardship activities are being conducted in outpatient settings as well. So the next challenge that we're working on at Pew right now is really about taking the lessons and what worked really well for the successes of antibiotic stewardship experiences in the inpatient or the hospital setting, and trying to find ways to translate that into the outpatient setting where the majority of antibiotics are being prescribed.
Great. So again, we see both in your paths and in your current practice, you're sort of two sides of the coin. You're working to influence the field of medicine to more appropriate use and less abuse, and you're working to develop new ones in the pipeline to replace the inevitable loss of efficacy of existing antibiotics. One thing I wanted to emphasize that you said is that stewardship programs, where you're tracking the data, you're looking at the use, you're monitoring it, and so on, training people, even physicians, in a hospital, in a large setting, that can work. But you said 80% of the human ingested antibiotics, not just ingested, but human use of antibiotics, is outside of hospitals. It's in clinics, and there you've got this far-flung field. How do you reach them? How do you get to them? How do you give them the accountability tools and so on? I just want to sort of paint for people the issue there. One thing neither of you have spoken about yet, but I want you to speak to, David, is the use of antibiotics in animal agriculture.
Yeah, that's another important area where there's a lot of room for improvement. And I'm sure a lot of folks have heard about how antibiotics are being used in some cases unnecessarily in animal agriculture or animal production facilities. And that's another area that Pew has worked on until very recently. We actually wound down that part of the work, at least at Pew, last year. But we've done a lot of work in advocating for appropriate use and improving antibiotic use in animal agriculture. There has been some progress made. I think the most common potential room for improvement everybody may have heard in the past is how animals were given antibiotics for the purposes of growth promotion, right?
So right, not because they were sick, not limited to sickness, not treating illness or even suspected illness, but they just, the agriculture producers found that it seemed to increase weight gain. They were used just for that. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was one of the first areas that the FDA a few years ago put out a new guidance, a regulatory guidance that said growth promotion, antibiotic use for growth promotion is not acceptable. And just from that guidance being finalized, starting a year later, we saw about a 30 to 35% drop in animal sales of antibiotics in animal agriculture settings, and that was one of those very good success stories in terms of like how policy that is backed by evidence, by public health evidence, can really drive home the needle. Now we still have a ways to go, right? But since we saw that initial drop, it sort of kind of dropped down even more as we've hoped. But that was a good first. Guidances and priorities that FDA has announced that they're going to work on a couple years ago as part of a 5-year plan that was published in 2018.
And that sounds like a sort of gray area. If you begin to counsel or even regulate that they can only use for treatment of disease and not for these other uses, then you begin to look at the gray areas within treatment of disease.
Right, right. Or in this case, prevention of disease.
Yeah,
yeah, right, exactly. One of the things as a physician I've noticed, I observed throughout all this is that there are a lot of parallels in terms of the challenges of reducing inappropriate antibiotic use when we're talking about animal agriculture and healthcare. It's a lot of it is driven by uncertainty from the prescriber or the provider standpoint. A lot of it is driven by diagnostic uncertainty. A lot of it is also driven by this fear or this will from the provider's perspective to make sure that, they ensure the best outcome for their patient, whether that patient is in the form of a human or an animal. So, and then the other challenge the parallel challenge that I notice in both fields is data. The best way to approach antibiotic stewardship is having data, not only data available, but the type of data you want is the one that can really drill down to the level of determining, okay, is this appropriate antibiotic use? Are the guidelines being followed? Or what were the specific, situations? We don't really want to go after like the outlier cases, but we really want to try to find these high yield situations where there is sort of this group pattern of prescribing that and looking at the data, we can say, okay, well, in these situations for these diagnoses, really antibiotics is not indicated. So let's try to find a way to reduce that. And what's driving this large amount of antibiotic use for these specific situations?
Okay, let me just tell people we're about the halfway mark here. This is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. And we're speaking, as you can see here, about the growing dangers and potential solutions to antibiotic resistance. And my guests are David Hune, who directs the Antibiotic Resistance Project at the Pew Charitable Trust, and Aaron Duffy, who's Chief of Research and Development at CARB-X, CARB-X, which stands for Combating Antibiotic Resistant Bacteria Biopharmaceutical Accelerator. And that's the key word, the accelerator. What they are is they fund and offer guidance to folks who are in the act of developing new antibiotics. You can learn more about David and Pew's work at Save antibiotics. That's one word, saveantibiotics.org, and about Aaron and Carb-X's work at carb-x.org. Before we move, I think we've painted a pretty good picture of the situation, the problem part of it. But one thing, with all of my personal prejudices, think that in agriculture, it's just huge companies who want to get whatever benefit they can. And how do we, you know, but in the human case, that 80% that's being prescribed in doctors' offices, what's the human behavior issue there? Because my guess is that in med school, every doctor learns that antibiotics only work with bacteria. And yet we know that they prescribe in cases that are not bacteria. David.
You're exactly right. It's rarely a medical knowledge issue. It's a lot of other things. And one of the key drivers of antibiotic overuse or unnecessary prescribing that's been studied and published by researchers so far is the role that the patient plays. The patient can exert a significant amount of influence on this clinical decision-making process inside the doctor's head if they are coming in with what we call patient pressure or patient demand or patient expectations. It comes in many different terminologies, but it all means that the doctor or the healthcare provider senses this expectation from the patient during their interaction that the patient wants to leave the room, to leave the clinic visit with an antibiotic prescription in hand. And that is a tremendous driving force in a lot of the unnecessary antibiotic use that are antibiotic prescribing that we're seeing. And it doesn't even matter. Studies have actually shown this. It doesn't even matter if the patient really truly intended, that was their intention. If the doctor or the healthcare provider actually perceives it, even if the patient didn't actually have that intention or expectation, that's enough to override a lot of the medical knowledge to potentially prescribe the antibiotic.
Yeah, and the other thing that I would guess is in play here, and you may have dug deep enough into this to know, is that when you are limited to brief interactions with your patient, where you don't have time to talk much, they come in, they got a problem, you've got another patient in 20 minutes or 15 minutes, you've got to give them something that makes them feel better when they walk out of that office, not better physically necessarily, but better that you did something. My guess is that you're more likely to cave to perceived pressure when you don't have the time to really go into things.
Yeah, absolutely. Time is one of the things. I can attest to that as during my clinical years. It used to take me 20 to 30 minutes to talk somebody out of an antibiotic and convince them to actually sit down and go through the logic. I had the luxury of doing that because I was a subspecialist, so we have more time than the primary care doctors. The primary care doctors don't have that time. They have 15 minutes for sick visits, usually, for an acute sick visit. And especially if you don't have an established relationship with this patient, you're seeing a colleague's patient, or you're an urgent care doctor seeing a patient for the first time, that even adds to the challenge because you haven't really developed that rapport, the trust factor there, and trying to explain to and completely brand new face that why antibiotics may not be needed is a very tough challenge. I would also add, in addition to time, what compounds all of this is dying. We talked about this, I mentioned it earlier, about the diagnostic uncertainty, what you call the gray zone, right? The doctors, it's more often than not that from a provider standpoint, the diagnosis is not crystal clear. You know, when you see somebody in your clinic and you only have 15 minutes and you may not have all the diagnostic tools available that you want.
You may not have gotten the test you want yet, or that sort of thing, right?
Yeah, and you don't, or the test may take 2 days. You know, if you look at our COVID pandemic data, it took days for the virus test to come back. So in those situations, that compounds that, right? If there's a patient, there's a level of patient demand and patient pressure, you're not sure, 100% sure whether this patient has a bacterial infection or not, and you have a certain level of concern that this could be a bacterial infection, even though you're not sure, then the doctor or the provider is more likely to write that prescription, just what they think is going to be, just to be on the safe side. But and as Aaron mentioned earlier, it's really no longer to say that antibiotics can be prescribed just to be safe, because that's another aspect of this where antibiotics do carry a certain level of risk factors for side effects or for adverse events that could even land you in the hospital if you're take for, you know, as if these adverse events can be severe. So those are all the things that are just kind of crashing in at this 15 minute time period for the doctors.
Let me ask just one other question about the clinical practice for listeners' benefit. Then the notion that if you do get a prescription for antibiotics, to take the full compliance, 10 days, 2 weeks, whatever they say, is that a crucial piece? And what does that mean? Because I bet there's confusion about that.
And I think there's rightfully confusion about it, because it's a very complex topic. So yes, I would say, you know, the first and foremost advice I give patients is that you should listen to your doctor. You know, if your doctor wrote you 5 days or 10 days, that's the advice you should follow. But what, and to complete it, but what you're, the concern that's being raised recently is, are these, the doctors are following guidelines of what proper appropriate duration for treatment is, right? You know, and There are now, because of antibiotic stewardship, antibiotic resistance issues, there's been kind of a resurgence of new research that have been reevaluating sort of this dogmatic, in some sense, of what was passed down for a few decades about how long antibiotics need to be given. You know, it's my one of my ID infectious disease mentors used to call it, you know, antibiotics are given in football scores. It's either 7 days, 10 days, or 14 days, or 21 days. But now there's research showing, you know what, that pneumonia that we used to give 10 to 14 days for pneumonia, you can actually cure it in many simple cases in 5 days. And that's this research of trying to shrink down what is a true optimal duration of antibiotics. The reason I give that advice at the beginning about patients is that it's really, you know, you need to rely on your doctor to help you navigate through what the most current evidence is and what the most proper and optimal length of treatment is, rather than trying to navigate that yourself. So you still need to rely on your healthcare professionals to help you figure that out. But be reassured that I've been happy to see this new renewed interest in trying to reduce that recommended length of treatment. And even in kids with ear infections, we're starting to see that narrow down. It used to be 10 days when I was training, and now it's, you know, it's starting to go down to 7 days, and there's a lot more evidence that shorter treatment will work just as well.
And I'm going to throw this next question, and I'm still sort of trying to paint this picture, and we'll get into where the future, where the leverage is now and where the future might be. But Aaron, what situations create the greatest risk of antibiotic evolution, shall we say? In other words, people are used to, I think many people understand what happened with COVID. Now it's a virus, not a bacteria, but the notion was that if those who were unvaccinated and caught the virus were more likely to be the environments where the virus would evolve and mutate, and thus we come up with Omicron and Delta and those sorts of things. In the antibiotic world, or the biotic world, where the bacteria is the problem, are there certain things like length of time you take it or that sort of thing that makes it more likely that there will be these mutations which make them more dangerous to us, or is it just kind of a cumulative number?
That's an interesting question. I mean, you know, again, how viral infections and bacterial infections, you know, sort of evolve, you know, perhaps a little different. I think here, you know, resistance has always been part of life, okay? And so it's, and you know, their presentation is, you know, probably a mixture of many things. You know, certainly in enclosed environments, you know, I think a place we think about a lot, long-term care facilities, right? So you have people who are vulnerable in many ways, and compromised, whatever, and then you have an infection, you know, in that environment, which is, you know, not hospital environment, but not completely in the community either. But those are areas where, you know, disease can be spread.
So what we saw with COVID, you're saying, is somewhat similar in terms of vulnerable environments with bacteria.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you an example. So there's a bacterial pathogen called Acinetobacter baumannii, you know, just flows right off the tongue. But that you know, people always consider to be actually a productive pathogen in the soil. So not, you know, pathogenic to people, you know, something we really need in the environment. And that was true. But then I think maybe famously, it has been given the moniker Iraqibacter because, you know, during, you know, the war, you know, you had bombs going off and, you know, you're in the desert and whatever, and the soldiers, U.S. soldiers end up with these terrible wounds and there's dirt in the wounds, and then there are these ships where maybe they have not enough antibiotics or not the right antibiotics, because, by the way, no one walks in anywhere with a t-shirt that says, you know, this wound is affected with Acinetobacter baumannii. They present with the wound.
That's right. That's those 2 or 3 days I was talking about in my situation, exactly. Where we've taken a culture. We do that immediately as soon as we see the infection, but we don't know immediately what's going to work.
Exactly.
Or if anything's going to work.
Or if anything's going to work. And so, you know, they have what they have on these ships. And then, you know, when these, you know, soldiers came back, you know, they would often end up in long-term care facilities. And then all of a sudden, Acinetobacter is a term that people are talking about with, you know, infections in long-term care facilities and then, of course, in the hospital. So again, something that I think 15 years ago, if you'd have asked someone like David, you know, what's the biggest pathogen you see, I can promise you he would never have said Acinetobacter baumannii. Today he might say that. So I think there are many ways that these things can.
One thing you mentioning the Iraq War and battlefield injuries, I think one of the things that I remember hearing many years ago, but still remains true, is that most of the deaths in the U.S. Civil War were not gunshot, were not hand-to-hand combat, they were infections.
Absolutely.
And here we are, you know, many, many years later. We've kind of laid out the problem, and it's both in human overuse and animal overuse, and we're working to change that. Is there any quick story that either of you can tell about how we got here? Was there a time when things were in balance and the incentives made sense, and did something happen to throw it off?
The truth is that, you know, the evolution of bacteria isn't different, okay? As I said, this is what they do. Okay, they make stuff and then they fight each other. The difference is, I think, that as the field of molecular biology evolved, okay, which has been over the last, I'm going to date myself, but let's say, you know, 30 years, all of a sudden, our tools to be able to look at other disease areas where we haven't had, you know, successful treatments, you know, and probably the area that you think about most is oncology, just the explosion of knowledge and tools to look at how to target what is, you know, let's be honest, cancer's on everybody's mind. Am I going to get it? How am I going to get it? Where am I going to get it? You know, and you know, is it going to be cured? And so with the evolution of biology and technology to be able to address these therapeutic areas, naturally there has been a shift to emphasize these. And what's come along with that is investment in these areas. You know, so there's a paper that was produced recently by colleagues at Bio that compared sort of the number of, you know, oncology products in clinical trials today versus those in antibiotics. And it was a couple of orders of magnitude different.
A lot of listeners probably don't know what a couple of orders of magnitude means. What does that mean?
You know, I don't remember the numbers, but let's say, you know, like 1 to 10 is 1 order of magnitude. 10 to 100 is 2.
Okay, so it might be 100 times more investment in cancer than in antibiotics.
Oh, it's a lot.
Oh, and way more than that. Okay, there you get the picture, folks. Okay, so we've got sort of the evidence that we've got a broken system. We've got what the effects of that are. Where do we go from here? And let me go to you, David, because I know I'm going to lose you in a bit. What's working and why is it working in terms of meeting this challenge?
Yeah, I think from antibiotics, there has been some positive progress in finding ways to improve antibiotic use. We still have a long way to go in terms of trying to minimize how much unnecessary use is happening both in the animal sector and human healthcare. But what gives me what's been promising is that we've seen positive steps, and both at the scientific level, at the clinical science level, And at the policy level, that has shown, shown improvement in the direction that we wanted to see. And I think the challenge moving forward is to make sure that those things are continue to be amplified. I mentioned earlier about the successes of antibiotic stewardship programs in hospitals. And I think that's one of the key, a very good successful example of how things that was started at the clinical science level in just a handful of hospitals, maybe 20, 30 years ago, began gathering momentum. There was more and more research being published, and not just research on it. It was mostly research on implementation science research. It was about, how to measure antibiotic use and how to basically improve the specific area of quality of care to the patients in the hospital when it comes to antibiotic use. And that the cumulative research that grew eventually got translated into a consensus among both the clinicians, the healthcare stakeholders, and the regulatory agencies and the public health agencies to say, this should be a standard across all hospitals. This should be expected, having some kind of a structured antibiotic stewardship program. So that led to 2017, when the Joint Commission for the first time said that, okay, we're, for those hospitals that we're surveying for accreditation, we expect all the hospitals to have these antibiotic stewardship programs employed.
And what are the efforts ongoing to bring this to the clinical practice outside of hospitals?
Outside of hospitals, it's very new. It's still pretty early in the stage when you consider how far we've made progress in the hospital side of things. But I will say it is starting to, become more visible on the stewardship experts' radars. You have these stewardship, and I think the most common example we see that is health systems, right? Like these are sort of these large conglomerate of not just hospitals, but a lot of the hospitals, they have affiliated, outcomes.
Right, and let me just jump in very quickly, David, and say, this is really the trend. The exception might be in rural areas, which is a whole other issue, which we don't have time to deal with, which is rural healthcare. But in urban areas, to be able to afford the electronic record keeping, small practices have had to merge and become part of larger practices. And almost every doctor that I see in Los Angeles, Santa Monica, Long Beach, California, they're in a larger group.
Yeah.
But that has a positive for what we're talking about, though.
Exactly, because these large health systems include hospitals that have that experience and expertise that built up the stewardship programs from the hospital setting. And now they can use the same expertise and resources to try to find a way to replicate their successes in outpatient setting. One quick example I'll give you, and a shout out to one of the health systems that we work with very closely, is Intermountain Healthcare in Utah. They actually include a lot of rural facilities in Utah and Idaho, and they've created this great network of hospital-based stewardship. And a few years ago, that same stewardship team that was in charge of trying to build all the stewardship programs across the different hospitals network turned their eyes on their urgent care centers. And they have a lot of urgent care centers throughout the state of Utah. And so they started applying the same methods about measuring antibiotic use and sharing the measuring prescribing patterns with the urgent care doctors to show them how they're prescribing, what their prescribing looks like compared to their peer doctors, and who's really prescribing at a much more higher level than others. And as soon as they implemented that, they started seeing within weeks reduction of antibiotic use for largely unnecessary conditions among their providers. So that's a great way of translating what's worked extremely well in the hospital setting, and the same experts using the same type of resources they had and going across the street essentially to these healthcare facilities outside the hospital and trying to replicate those successes.
Very good. Okay. I want to be fair to you, David. You've got to go. Thank you very much for today and for the work you're doing and for the work that's going on at Pew Charitable Trust. The one thing I'll ask you to do before you leave is tell people what listeners can do to learn more about the field and about what you're doing, because I get your newsletter on a regular basis, and this will keep the urgency in front of people's faces.
Yeah, two things I can think of off the bat. I think the first is a lot more personal. When you get sick the next time, for your listeners, and most likely it's some kind of a viral illness or a respiratory infection, when you go see your doctor's office, we ask the patients to keep an open mind when they walk into the office. We mentioned about the tremendous influence that the patient has on the clinical decision-making process that may turn out to be the wrong or maybe unnecessary prescription of antibiotics. So we always say the best thing you can do is bring out things out into the open, open up a clear communication channel with your doctors, express your expectations. Don't let your doctors try to guess what your expectations are for this visit. What do you want out of that visit? And when antibiotics are being discussed, ask about the side effects, ask about the adverse events, ask about the certainty or any kind of diagnostic certainty, and try to make that as openly, as transparently as possible so that you can kind of, that's the best way to relieve the amount of patient demand, the perceived patient demand and expectations of antibiotics. And the last thing I'll ask is,
patients have to partner in this.
Absolutely, because we know from research that patients have already a significant influence in this process.
Let's make it an influence for the better.
Yeah, exactly. Whether they intended it to be or not. And the last thing I'll say is that if, especially for the really motivated listeners who are potentially politically active or like to have their voices heard, there are a lot of moving policies that we talked about just in this podcast about it on Congress and at the federal level and sometimes in the state level. Keep an eye on those things, and your voice matters. If you see something that a bill that talks about antibiotic resistance, antibiotic stewardship, or antibiotic development. More recently, like the Pasteur Act that's in Congress right now. If you see that, read it. And if you have the time, read it. And if you feel that this really deserves the spotlight it does, then have your voice heard to your elected officials.
And if they go to saveantibiotics.org, they can then sign up for the newsletter and action alerts, which I get when there's something going on in the legislature. And somebody needs to hear from me, I'm told by you guys. Thank you very much, David. Keep up your good work.
Thank you, Terrence, for having me.
We got a few more minutes, Aaron. And so my question to you is, what about the incentives and what about the future?
Yeah, no, so I'm glad you asked, especially following on what David just said. So let me just break it down into three parts. Okay, so what's required for the future, and this will include the incentives, is you need this resident, passionate, expert group of scientists who want to bring new products forward. Okay, we have that. In our case right now, 50 companies from around the world who are active in our portfolio. So you have that. We want to continue to maintain that. There's a series of what we call push incentives, and that basically translates into funding, like what we do. Okay, but it's at all stages along the continuum. So you have groups like the NIH, National Institutes of Health, where, of course, Dr. Fauci has been, we all know who Fauci is. They support the very basic science that's in, the universities that often is the sort of seed from which the plant grows.
Okay, the foundation, on which anything that ever becomes clinical or practical is going to be built.
Exactly, right? So in the case of the, Pfizer and Moderna COVID vaccines, okay, they were supporting the basic research around mRNA vaccines, almost two decades ago.
That's right. How they could come up with an entirely new model of vaccine in less than a year is because the groundwork had been done.
Exactly.
Funded by us through the NIH.
Exactly. So that's an early push. We're in a different push, which is post that sort of, crazy basic science. And now how do we translate that basic science into something that can move into patients? And that's what we fund. And there are others. But we're a big funder in this space. And I should say, by the way, that our funding comes from three international governments, the US, UK, and German government. As well as the Wellcome Trust and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And it's substantial. We've deployed, I think, $361 million over 5 years to support these programs. But then downstream from us, because we don't want to build the bridge to nowhere, there have been, BARDA, the Biomedical Research Authority, who, did support a lot of the COVID work and all of the pillars, they do advanced development of antibiotics, not only to protect Americans from, you know, these antimicrobial infections like you've had, but also for, you know, national and international security. So protection against bioterrorism should, you know, bacteria be weaponized. But recently, 2 years ago recently, almost 2 years ago recently, something called the AMR Action Fund was created. And that's critical, okay, because this was all the big pharmaceutical companies, as well as the Wellcome Trust and the Novo Nordisk Foundation and others coming together with a substantial pot of money to really essentially take from where we end, which is the demonstration that it's safe in humans, through to approval as a new drug and licensure. And so that group has been set up. And probably, if you think about it, the reason these big companies have done this is A, because they understand and appreciate the challenge of AMR, but importantly, you know, the threat of antimicrobial resistance threatens their base franchises, right? Whether it's, you know, oncology drugs or, you know, anything else, right? So you want to have this stable so you can do your prosthetic joint infection.
That's right. No, to go back to what I said way at the top.
Yes.
If you cannot take antibiotics, you will not get a joint replacement.
Exactly.
And so that's just gone. As I say, that's something of the past. Transplants. Again,
yes.
I mean, so much of what is so critical. And in fact, in COVID, they found that we had a great bump in antibiotic use not because it was treating the virus, but because they were vulnerable patients in hospitals.
Exactly. And that's exactly right. Okay. So they've done this and here we are. But what's missing? Okay. What's missing is this fundamental change in the marketplace. Okay. So how do you make it so that little companies like mine, you know, don't have to make the decisions that we made? And that's called a pull incentive. Okay. Now, the UK piloted the first one of these, and I guess they picked their first two antibiotics. It's so hard because during COVID, it's like this it's extended 2 year period that stuff happened in, you know. But anyway, so I think it was in 2021, they chose their first two antibiotics, and what it's called, sort of in you know, layman's terms, is a Netflix model. Okay. So you are decoupling, importantly, the sales from the access of the drug. Okay.
Right. So in other words, you might make your decision not based on estimated profits, but on estimated positive outcomes.
Yes, exactly. Right. So you decouple these things. And so it's basically, it's not really stockpiling, but we are saying here are antibiotics with serious societal value. Okay. We're going to basically buy them and incentivize the people who brought them forward in a meaningful way so that they can continue to do their business, right? Here in the US, actually, this is a great example of a partnership in Congress between Senators Bennett, who's a Democrat from Colorado, and Young, who's a Republican from, I think, Indiana. And they have together pushed forward. David mentioned it, the so-called Pasteur Act.
So the name of the act is named after Louis Pasteur.
This is basically this de-linked Netflix type model where basically the company doesn't have to build up the SG&A force, which is massive, okay? But so it basically is, again, used based on subscriptions, but you're not having to build that infrastructure. That's critical. Okay, because all of our organizations, except for the NIH, but we're meant to sundown. We're not meant to be here forever. But what we're doing is keeping the fires burning, or whatever that phrase is, of potential new innovation so that you don't get to the place where you say, oh my, I've had this infection, there's nothing to treat it. But we need the market to be fixed. And that's where Pasteur comes in. And so what can people on this podcast do? Write to your senator and congressman and say, please pass Pasteur, because this will be transformational.
It will change the incentives, or at least enough of them to make a significant difference. We've got to bring this to a close, but we covered everything I wanted to cover for sure.
So again, the projects are the Antibiotic Resistance Project at the Pew Charitable Trust,
and CARB-X, that's CARB, C-A-R-B hyphen X, led by Boston University, and the websites are saveantibiotics.org. One word, saveantibiotics.org and CARB-X.org, CARB-X.org. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, join me in pursuit of a world that just might work. Go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcements telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 10 links to articles relevant and timely that I think you'd like, you can sign up at my site, or you can email me at T-E-McNally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, T-E-McNally at Mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to Freeform Podcast at Apple Podcasts and most major podcast sites, and you'll find years of podcasts at my site or at most of those sites. And you can also follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to Kiana Williams in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all to you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. Thank you, Aaron Duffy, and keep up your good work.